Don't move a muscle. The podcast is starting.
Hello, and welcome to Podtrificus Totalis, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. I'm your host, Cassie.
And I'm Joe.
And we're here for the last chapter in this book, the first book, chapter 17, The Man with Two Faces. It is my turn to do the chapter summary, and here we go. Harry meets Quirrell in the last chamber of this, like, death maze that they've been in for the past chapter, and Quirrell reveals that he was trying to steal the Philosopher's Stone for Voldemort all along, not Snape. Quirrell can't get the stone from the Mirror of Erised, which is there in the room with them, and he tries to use Harry for it. Harry gets the stone, but he lies to Quirrell to protect the stone. Quirrell reveals that Voldemort's face is on the back of his head and is covered by his turban. Voldemort knows that Harry lied about the stone and he taunts him. Eventually, Quirrell attacks Harry, but Harry's touch burns his skin. Harry passes out and wakes up in the hospital wing where Dumbledore explains what happened. Gryffindor wins the house cup and the kids go home.
Short and sweet.
Yep, that's the gist of it. And so, of course, we're going to talk about this in a lot more detail than that.
Just a little bit.
Yes. So how do you feel about this Quirrell twist? You were surprised. I know. Your jaw dropped to the floor.
Yes. As the first line said, it was Quirrell.
Yeah. It helped too that the picture for the chapter was of Quirrell.
I was a little disappointed that they also kind of give away what's up with him right away in the title, The Man with Two Faces?
I mean, yes, but, and we're going to talk about this in more detail, but that can be taken as the figurative being two-faced.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but yeah, with the picture of him unwrapping the turban and the chapter title, they do kind of give it away. But I like this twist a lot. And I think that the reason it works so well, and really the reason all the twists in Harry Potter work so well, is that they're covered really well. There's evidence leading up to them if you know where to look for it. But I think that very few readers would have been able to call this twist. It's hard to reflect back on our first time experiencing it, because for me, it was the movie when I was like 6 years old and I've forgotten. And for you, I assume it was also the movie.
I think my mom had read the very first book to me before we watched the movie.
OK, well, you can barely remember what you had for breakfast. So
we did not eat breakfast.
Okay, but you get my point. We can't remember our reaction. But like I was saying, like, the twists in the series are covered so well, and there's evidence if you know where to look for it, but very few will be able to piece it together on their own before it's actually revealed. That evidence is really just innocuous details throughout the book. So, like, at the Quidditch match, when they think they see Snape muttering a curse to make Harry's broom freak out.
Yeah, it turns out to be the counter curse.
And there was like a throwaway line in that scene that Hermione that knocked over Quirrell, yeah, which breaks his eye contact. So I think that makes these twists really satisfying at the end of the book. There's good build up to them. And you're like, oh my gosh, how was I such an idiot for missing these details? But they were such, you know, trivial details in the process of reading the book when you didn't know that Quirrell was a bad guy.
Yeah, especially because on top of that, she does add a lot of other, like, throwaway lines. We hear a lot about, oh, here's one thing that Fred and George did, and then yeah, we're going to forget about it.
Yeah, and like Flitwick was there too. You know, you could theoretically suspect any of the professors because there's about as much detail about them as there is Quirrell. Not really, but you get what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So I like this twist. I think it works really well. It is a little contrived to have a twist in the last chapter like this. Oh, he's a real villain, but it works. It's a children's story.
Yeah. Yeah. It works well. We do get the very stereotypic, like, oh, the good guy's tied up, let me explain everything to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Which feels a little silly. I think that Quirrell does say at the beginning, though, that he's not going to let Harry live through this process. He's just keeping him there long enough to get the stone, and then he's going to, you know, kill him. But yeah, so it is silly that the evil villain tends to spill all their plans and everything right before.
And this wasn't even spilling his plans. It was like, all that time, here's what was actually going on.
Yeah.
It just felt like J.K. Rowling saying, like, here's pointing back at all the little pieces I hid.
Right. And again, it's a children's book.
Yeah.
If you were a more advanced reader or an older reader at the time, you might be able to put that together. And if you're a kid reading this book at the time, too, you might be able to put it together when you realize this twist. Like, oh, yeah, this is what happened. But it helps to have Rowling point it out,
yes,
for you, for a younger reader. So Harry is stunned by this twist. He's like, but I thought Snape, what? And Quirrell is like, it was useful to have Snape swooping around like an overgrown bat. And I think this is the best simile we've encountered in the whole book. An overgrown bat. It's such a good descriptor for Snape. I love it.
And I like that it's just saying, oh, Snape's the only one that wears a cloak. Like all the professors
are. All wear cloaks.
Exactly.
But Snape is distinctly wearing a black coat and just kind of like flitting around the castle. I don't know. I picture him like Dracula, like pulling the cloak up to his
face. Yeah. What are you doing indoors?
Yeah.
It may seem suspicious.
Yeah. So I did like that simile, and I like that kind of throwaway line of like, yeah, you did think it was him.
Yeah.
So that made me laugh. I liked that a lot. So I want to talk about Quirrell now that he's revealed for who he really is, because we kind of talked about him a little bit when he was first introduced in the chapter where they go to the Leaky Cauldron, but now we can talk about him more fully because we actually know who he is. So I actually want to read a little bit from his Pottermore page, because there is a good bit that Rowling wrote about his background that we don't really get in the book.
All right.
He talks a little bit about how he hooked up with Voldemort, but she gives more background. So let me pull that up.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm reading directly off of the Pottermore page here, and I'll link it in the show notes as always. These are paragraphs 2 and 3. And this is Rowling writing directly. So she says, I saw Quirrell as a gifted but delicate boy who would probably have been teased for his timidity and nerves during his school life. Feeling inadequate and wishing to prove himself, he developed an initially theoretical interest in the dark arts. Like many people who feel themselves to be insignificant, even laughable, Quirrell had a latent desire to make the world sit up and notice him. Quirrell set out deliberately to find whatever remained of the dark wizard, partly out of curiosity, partly out of that unacknowledged desire for importance. At the very least, Quirrell fantasized that he could be the man who tracked Voldemort down, but at best, might learn skills from Voldemort that would ensure he was never laughed at again. And there's more on that page, but that's the part that I felt was most interesting and most important. Yeah, and I think that's an interesting background that she attaches to the character, because as we see with people who commit awful crimes and do awful things, I'm not going to go into anything too specific in detail, but a lot of the time it stems from feeling rejected from society in some way, whether it's being bullied as a child or being perceived as an outsider. Those people will sometimes, not always, sometimes go on to do things as if to prove to people that they have that power that they felt deprived of in their childhood. So I thought that was an interesting background for Quirrell.
Yeah, we may have talked about this. I feel like they talk about it when he's first introduced. But does he develop the stutter when he comes back from that vacation after he had supposedly found Voldemort? Or did he have it and then overcame it with dark arts? I don't know.
That's what the dark arts are for.
Yes, overcoming that's what he stutter. Used it for, having a better laugh and not stuttering.
Yeah. So we do discover through this chapter that he's been putting on the stutter this whole time, because he talks calmly and without a stutter throughout this whole chapter. I'm not sure. I don't think they mention that specifically. It does kind of go into that whole image that he has of being timid and nervous, which indicates to me that maybe he had that as a child, kind of learned to overcome it as an adult, but then put it back on to kind of mask himself later on.
Okay.
I don't know. It's hard to say. That's an interesting theory, though.
I feel like I remember them saying he came back from that trip very scared. I'm looking it up right now. So
okay.
I'm sure it's somewhere and I just didn't find it.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I'm not sure whether he always had the stutter. Maybe somebody can email in and tell us. I also want to talk about Quirrell's first name. Do you know what it is?
Quirinus.
So this is what Rowling wrote also on the Pottermore page at the bottom. Quirinus was a Roman god about whom there is not much information, although he is commonly associated with war, a clue that Quirrell is not quite as meek as he appears. Quirrell, which is so nearly squirrel, small, cute, and harmless, also suggested quiver, a nod to the character's innate nervousness. We talked about the squirrel thing when he was first introduced, but Quirinus is an interesting name. So unlike what Pottermore says, there is a lot of information about this Roman god. Quirinus is an epithet or a second name, kind of. Epithet means something else modernly, but in the Greek conception of it, epithet is like another name for someone. So like my real name is Cassandra. An epithet for that might be Cassie.
So that's just AKA.
Yeah, kind of. So Quirinus is another name for the Roman god Janus, who also has two faces, one in the front, one in the back. And Janus represents duality, basically, in Roman mythology. He's a Roman god. That's important. He does not have a Greek equivalent. He's purely an invention of the Romans. So Janus represents duality, past and present, war and peace, good and evil, basically opposites, kind of beginning and end. And that one is particularly interesting here because this is the beginning of the Harry Potter series, our first kind of introduction to Voldemort, but also the end of the book. So that's a fun little duality that we have going on there.
And the end of Quirrell.
Yeah. So Janus is one of the most important gods in the Roman pantheon, if not the most important. He's typically considered next to Jupiter, who is like the Zeus of Roman mythology. And Galadriel is the one that set me on this path, actually. Galadriel, who wrote The Ultimate Unofficial Guides to the Mysteries of Harry Potter. She writes that Janus is the namesake of January, which looks both back at the previous year while looking forward to the next year, i.e. the next book. This chapter leads into Chamber of Secrets, the next book. It's looking back on the year of Philosopher's Stone that led up to this mystery, as well as opening the door to this next chapter. That's a very interesting theory. There's some evidence that the Romans didn't actually name January for Janus, but instead for Juno, who is the like female principal god of Roman mythology. She's Hera in Greek mythology. So nice thought, but might not be accurate. And another interesting thing about Janus is that in the play Othello, Shakespeare's Othello, if you're not familiar with it, it's one of his most famous tragedies. And it's basically about deception and lying. And Iago is a major character in it who kind of works to take down Othello, who he's felt wronged by. And Iago, early on in the play, swears by Janus. And this to Othello, not knowing Iago's true intentions, just thinks like, I swear to God, I didn't do anything. Not that it's that context, but like, it's not taken as anything troubling, but with the context of who Iago actually is, a manipulator, a betrayer, it's again interesting to have him reference a two-faced character, a two-faced god specifically. So again, pointing to that duality. And Quirrell, if you think about it, is kind of an Iago in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Iago, for others like Joe, might be more familiar as the bird in Aladdin. The red bird.
No, I didn't know his name, I guess.
Yeah, it's Iago.
Cool.
It's a reference to Othello. Yeah, so Quirrell's first name being a literal direct pull from the Roman god is interesting. And it is, I didn't want to mention it earlier on because that would have given away a lot about who Quirrell actually is.
Yes, it's fun looking back at the book and being able to talk about the whole thing.
Yeah.
Who knows how much of that we'll actually get into this episode.
Yeah. But so Quirrell is both literally and figuratively two-faced, we learn in this chapter, which is
very fun. Literally.
Very literally. Voldemort is literally growing out of the back of his head.
And what was interesting about that, I don't know if I had like figured this out and forgot about it, but apparently Voldemort wasn't always on the back of his head.
Yes.
Since he found him. Voldemort was on the back of his head since he failed to steal the
stone
originally.
Yeah.
No, not on Halloween, since he failed to steal it from Gringotts. Right.
Yes, from Gringotts, which is important because
that's how he was able to shake Harry's hand when he first met him.
Yes, at the Leaky Cauldron, because Harry like thinks back to that. And yeah. So that's very important that he wasn't always on the back of his head.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's an interesting detail. He was always working for Voldemort, but Voldemort was not always...
Yes, and as a punishment.
Yeah, as a punishment, which
to
is...
To punish me,
yeah.
He decided to keep a closer eye on me.
Yeah.
And now he lives on the back of my head.
Yeah. It was very prescient, though, of Quirrell to start wearing the turban. Was he wearing the turban at the Leaky Cauldron?
He was wearing it since he came back.
Since he came back.
From that trip.
So he did have it on at the Leaky Cauldron.
Yes.
So it was, it showed a bit of foresight for him to start wearing the turban before he had Voldemort on his
head. I guess so.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe he really did win it from, or not win it, he was awarded it.
By the prince?
By,
It was an African prince for like slaying a yeti
like a zombie
or something.
Yeah.
that was his story, of course. This was a small little note, but Quirrell says he has a special gift with trolls.
Yes.
I like to think that there's like, you know, there's muggle studies and care of magical creatures and troll studies at Hogwarts. That was just weird. I didn't know why that was there.
Well, it would explain why you would think, oh, it was him that brought the troll in. And it was him that had the troll as part of the trap for the Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah. And he said, like, you saw what I did to him back there, right? He was really messed up. it just weird. I could have done without that.
Well, that was part of the exposition-y, like, oh, Miss Granger knocked me over as she rushed to get Snape.
Yeah, I know. But just the line, I have a special, what was it? A special gift with trolls. It was weird. But yeah, so Quirrell and Voldemort do this big info dump for Harry while he's tied up and they're trying to figure out how to get the stone. And one of the huge things that he tells Harry is that Snape had been protecting him all this time, and that Snape went to Hogwarts with Harry's parents, James and Lily, and he hated James. And yes. I believe this is the first we hear about that.
It is. And Dumbledore...
Dumbledore talks about it more in detail.
We'll get to that conversation.
Yeah, we're trying to go mildly chronologically here. yeah, but that is the first we hear about that. And that becomes a huge deal in the later books.
And they kind of move past the explanation we get in this chapter.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Quirrell delivers like the ultimate villain line. There is no good and evil. There is only power and those too weak to seek it. It's a good line. I feel like Emperor Palpatine could say this line.
You give that to any villain.
Yeah, any villain.
Yeah.
This is definitely like the iconic villain line for Quirrell, though. And I want to talk a little bit about moral philosophy.
Oh boy.
So this line very much resembles the philosophy of Nietzsche, who is a German philosopher, probably one of the most famous philosophers. So you might have heard the name before. And I want to read a little bit that from this book that I've been reading called Into the Pensieve, The Philosophy and Mythology of Harry Potter by Patrick McCauley.
McCauley?
It's got two C's.
Can I see?
Yeah.
McCauley.
Okay. So he writes about this line specifically and who Nietzsche is, and I think that he did it better than I could and with more of an informed stance than I could. So I'm just going to read directly. Friedrich Nietzsche took this line of thinking a step further, the idea of power. This German philosopher from the late 1800s seemed to have thought that we were fundamentally and primarily driven by a desire to maximize our power over and against those around us. He seems to have felt that there is a part of every one of us that desires, above all else, to be in charge, in command, the boss. This same part of us heartily resents being told what to do. He called this part of us the will to power. This part of us loves to acknowledge and take note of every increase of power we come by. We tend to regard every increase in our allowance, every advance in grade at school, every expansion of our liberty as unquestioned benefits. And he also relates this to Machiavelli and The Prince with the ends justify the means. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting connection there. Like this line could have been lifted directly out of Nietzsche's writings about the will to power. The will to power is basically this idea that you need to exert your own personal power over reality to manipulate it to your will. So like if you say like, I can't do that, like I'm not smart enough, you're not exerting your will to power. If you do exert your will to power, you know, you learn how to do it and you do whatever it takes to bend reality to your will and get the goal, the ends that you want.
Yeah.
And that's what Quirrell is basically advocating here for. It also very much resembles the relativist ethical theory of egoism, the idea that you ought to act in pursuit of your own self-interest or self-pleasure if you're looking at it from a hedonistic perspective. But yeah, this is classic villain stuff, basically. This is the philosophy that underscores like basically any villain in popular media. So I like this line a lot because it's just that encapsulated in a format really that's understandable for children. You don't have to directly quote from Nietzsche to, you know, summarize his ideas and make your villain be like, oh, that guy is clearly evil.
Yes.
So I like to address some of that philosophy background. But yeah, Joe is smiling at me and telling me to move on.
I'm not telling you to do anything. I would like to say I could have commented on that, but I was so focused on the twins hitting Voldemort in the face.
Yes. Yeah, that is another realization. Somehow Quirrell doesn't mention this when he goes through all the little things that we missed along the way. Yeah, but in one of the chapters, they had a snowball fight and Fred and George were throwing snowballs at the back of Quirrell's turban. They do also reiterate something that I think Fred and George first mentioned about the funny smell coming from the turban. Fred and George say like, oh, he's got garlic in there to ward off vampires. And Harry repeats it again, which, like, does Voldemort smell?
I think Voldemort smells like death.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
I think Voldemort smells rot.
I was like, does dark magic have a smell?
No, I think a snake corpse on your head, constantly covered in with a cloth.
Mm, yeah.
It's going to, at the very least, get very sweaty.
Smart, 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 smart.
But so this is in chapter 12, the Mirror of Erised, where this throwaway line is, the lake froze solid and the Weasley twins were punished for bewitching several snowballs so that they followed around Quirrell, bouncing off the back of his turban.
Yes.
So they spent some time enchanting snowballs to smack Voldemort in the face.
Yeah. And it takes Harry 7 books to deal with Voldemort. Should have just let the Weasleys do their thing. So Quirrell is unable to get the stone from the mirror. He knows the mirror is the key to getting the stone, but he can't seem to get it. So Quirrell hears a voice from the back of his turban saying, use the boy. And Quirrell unties Harry and puts him in front of the mirror and says, you take a look. You see if you can get it. And I like that Quirrell has to ask what Harry sees in the mirror. He can't see it for himself, because I feel that was kind of built up to in the scene, also in chapter 12, where Harry takes Ron to see the mirror.
And yeah, they have saying, to, hey, look at my family.
Yeah, they have to explain to each other what they're seeing. So this is something that I just think it was good that Rowling had established beforehand, that you can't just like look in the mirror and see what somebody else is seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's very important here.
Yeah, and I like the idea of just like, oh, here's Harry's reflection slyly saying, there it is. It's in my pocket. There it is. It's back in my pocket.
Yeah. I had the Lego set for this scene. And well, we have the Lego set now, too. But the new Lego set. But yeah, it was just like a little spinny panel of like regular Harry. And then you spin it and it's Harry holding the stone and you can just like keep spinning it around. It was fun. I liked it a lot. Yeah. So Quirrell's like, what do you see in the mirror? Tell me. And Harry's like, I won the house cup.
I'm shaking hands with Dumbledore.
Yeah. Basically taking Ron's heart's desire and lying. As in, like, this is a nonsense thing. You can't actually think that I'm seeing this.
Well, no, that's like just the typical, this is what a child would want. This is a reasonable desire.
Yeah, I guess.
Although, I don't know if Quirrell knows that it's the Mirror of Erised or what that does. So he could have said pretty much anything, because in Quirrell's mind, he might not be thinking, oh, he better be telling me a desire.
I feel like he knew what the mirror did when he was looking at it, like leading up to this. I mean, the mirror also says what it does on the top. You just have to figure out, you have to read it backwards.
Well, Quirrell was examining the back of the mirror, so.
Okay. But Quirrell also could have deduced that the mirror shows your desire, because he says, like, I see myself with the stone, giving it to my master.
Well, he knows that the stone is
hidden somehow
by the mirror.
Yeah.
And he even contemplates, oh, should I break the mirror?
Okay. So, I mean, like, even if he doesn't know that it's the deepest desire.
Yeah. It was smart of Harry to use, like, oh, this is Ron's.
A believable lie.
A typical desire of a child. Like, yeah. Oh, I'm going to be a house champion.
Yeah. Yeah. So Harry lies, and Voldemort seems to know that Harry is lying. He says, like, he lies. That was beautiful. He says he lies. Let me talk to him. I'll shake it out of him. And I think this is an interesting thing, too, that kind of alludes to stuff later on in the series, that Voldemort knows when Harry is lying.
Yes, but I do like that after Quirrell gets this information, Quirrell yells at him, tell me the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, now you're convinced. You better tell me.
So Quirrell unturbans himself.
And yes, he unwraps his head.
Yeah, and he reveals the Voldemort face, which is chalk white with glaring red eyes and slits for nostrils like a snake. And throughout the series, Voldemort is aligned with snakes. Snakes being a symbol of deception and manipulation and ultimately
and
evil. Yes, and Slytherin in Christian tradition. And I thought that it was interesting that Voldemort also says, there have always been those willing to let me into their hearts and minds, which points to him as this guy that kind of slithers in when people are weak, manipulates them, deceives them into, achieving his means and following him.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a good metaphor, if a little overdone.
Mm-hmm. So as Quirrell is talking to the back of his head before he unwraps his turban, he's saying, oh, you're not strong enough. And Voldemort talks about how the unicorn blood has strengthened me over mm-hmm. the past weeks. But I'm curious, did he have less of a face then? Was he...
I don't know if strength is relative to your facial features.
Well, I don't know why...
What are you trying to say?
Well, I don't know why it was dangerous for him to take off the turban if Voldemort wasn't that strong. Like, oh, you're not strong enough to... Like, for me to
I guess,
put you in the sunlight?
I guess there's the possibility... He's not a vampire. I guess there's the possibility that he could just overexert himself, maybe. Or... Harry could do something to mess up the back of his face and the turban is protecting it somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, but here it is. Voldemort and Harry are face to face and Voldemort does another info dump for Harry. he starts... In the movie, this is kind of presented as Voldemort trying to get Harry to join his side. I don't think that's really what happens in the book here. Voldemort is just trying to like get the stone out of Harry.
I mean, he's saying, come to my side.
He kind of... Well, I don't know.
Yes,
I don't think he said. Does he explicitly say that? I don't know. I'm reading very closely, apparently.
Don't be a fool. Better save your own life and join me.
Oh.
Or you'll meet the same end as your parents.
Oh, okay. I missed that. Yeah, but he does talk a lot about Lily and James. He says that he values bravery and describes James as courageous. This might just be an attempt to appeal to Harry. But I thought it was interesting, bravery being such an important thing in the series. Voldemort saying that he... values it. Because in a sense, if you think about it, bravery could be considered as a morally neutral thing. You're not necessarily doing a good thing when you're being brave.
No, you can bravely do something terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did think it was interesting that like we can have two characters whose really principal concerns and values are bravery, Harry and Voldemort, who are just polar opposites morally.
I don't know if Voldemort...
It's
one of his main things would
sure.
be bravery.
But you get what I'm saying.
Yes.
Yeah. and he also says that Lily needn't have died, which alludes to a detail that he was possibly willing to spare her. And that opens up the question of why. We learn the answer to that much later on.
Well, I think it wouldn't have been a sacrifice if he was just going to kill her.
Okay. There is more behind it than that. But it raises some flags because you're like, Lily is a muggle-born who Voldemort would probably hate and who he was killing rampantly. And he reveals that he's specifically there for Harry in
yes.
this scene. These are all details that will become very important later on. So we can just take it at face value, like you said, that it was the sacrifice that was important and gives Harry the power that he ultimately uses in this chapter to defeat Quirrell. But yeah, there is much more behind it.
Yes.
Yeah, so, but it is Lily's sacrifice that saves Harry here. So Quirrell reaches out to like get the stone from Harry because I guess he knows it's in Harry's pocket somehow.
Voldemort tells him.
Okay,
which,
Voldemort tells him.
For some reason, Voldemort couldn't have done with the turban.
He had to see it for himself.
Yeah.
With his red eyes. yeah, so Quirrell reaches out, grabs Harry, and his hand burns. And then Quirrell's like, I can't touch him. There's some kind of weird magic going on here.
And Voldemort doesn't care. He just keeps
He's
yelling,
like,
kill him.
You have him. You have a wand, dummy. Kind of calling back to the devil's snare scene.
Yes.
You're a witch. Kill him. And Harry, by instinct, it says explicitly, grabs Quirrell's face and burns him kind of to death.
Mind you. this is while he's pinned down under Quirrell's knees.
Yeah.
So Quirrell is terrible at pinning down children, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. But the by instinct thing, I think, was really interesting. Going back to a discussion we had with the chapter where they have detention, that was 15, I think. Harry acting by instinct in a lot of these scenes. He never has a plan going into these things. And part of that is just because he's put into these impossible situations with all these factors that, like, how could he possibly anticipate them?
Mm-hmm.
But, it's by instinct. He just knows what to do somehow.
Well, you just saw, oh, my skin is burning him. Let me do something, like literally anything to avoid being killed by this wand.
Yeah, but I like that highlighting of Harry's instincts.
Mm-hmm.
That he's able to get himself out of these situations. He figures out what to do somehow.
It seems more like a split second decision than yeah. like, oh, and
it could just be a self-preservation. No, but it says by instinct.
No, I know, but I feel like...
Yeah, but it can just be like a reflex, you know, like you touch the hot stove and you know to take your hand away and you don't think about it. But yeah, I think that this is part of that pattern of highlighting Harry's instincts and Harry as a character.
I mean, but I'm still okay with the idea of, oh, he thinks well on his feet.
Yeah, yes, that's what I'm saying.
But just saying it's an instinct.
I'm not
like
saying
he's
that
not
he,
making any real decisions.
I'm not saying that he has this like essential knowledge of like how to get out of all these situations. It's just Harry as a character works well in these high pressure situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When faced with this awful, horrible evil, you know, he doesn't just lay down and take it.
I feel like we're arguing the same thing.
Yeah. You're very combative today. Keep fighting me on all my good points. So Harry puts his hands on Quirrell's face. His head is burning from the pain of his scar. Quirrell's face is literally burning and Harry passes out.
Well, he's grabbing him like just by the arm by the end of it.
Is it grabbing Quirrell just by the arm?
Grabbing Quirrell by the arm. I feel like he got away from the face and he was just like, oh, I got to grab literally anything.
Yeah, but they're burning.
They're burning each other.
Burning and Harry's head is burning. And so Harry passes out. And he hears somebody shouting, Harry, Harry. He thinks it might be in his head, but he doesn't know. And he just blacks out.
Yeah, his only chance was to keep hold of Quirrell, keep him in enough pain to stop him from doing a curse. Not mm-hmm. even like, this is going to defeat him. This is just going to stall for time.
Yeah. This is kind of also, now that I'm thinking about it, it's not anticlimactic, but it's not really a battle. You know, I feel like all the other books kind of have a battle at the end.
Harry doesn't know enough magic to have a battle right now.
He could Wingardium Leviosa that thing.
He doesn't know Expelliarmus yet.
That's so true. Yeah. He doesn't have his crutch spell yet.
I did like before he passes out, Quirrell's screaming in pain. Harry's blind in pain. And Voldemort is still just yelling, kill him, kill him, as if that's going to help.
Yeah. He's encouraging Quirrell.
Yeah, he's the cheerleader on the sidelines.
Yeah.
Kill him, kill him. Yeah. No, he's like angrily, kill him. Seriously, just kill him. Yeah. Please, kill him.
Well, Voldemort probably doesn't understand what's happening because Dumbledore says later on, like, the one thing Voldemort can't understand is love. And it's the power of love that's allowing Harry to do this.
Yes.
So Voldemort, he also can't see what's happening because he's on the back of Quirrell's head.
See,
so he's
in my
just
mind,
looking at this empty room like, what's happening? Just kill him.
In my mind, this whole time, Quirrell's standing backwards and like reaching out backwards and grabbing at him.
That is absolutely not what's happening.
No, I know, but that's what I want to be happening.
It's not.
Yeah, because like I highlighted that while the turban's off and Voldemort's talking to Harry, Quirrell is stepping backwards. I was half expecting him to take over a little bit of control and like just walk backwards.
Yeah, that's interesting. How much control do you think Voldemort has over Quirrell like this? Because, I mean, they're sharing a body, but it seems like Quirrell is still ultimately in control.
Voldemort's very much just a parasite on the back of his head. I feel like Quirrell is in complete control. He must be able to instill some kind of pain, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a punishment to have him there, and he's forcing Quirrell to do all these awful things like slay unicorns and drink their blood.
Yeah.
Do you think Quirrell is a sympathetic character?
No, I think that's intentionally squashed in this chapter.
He is very terrible in this chapter. But knowing his background of, I don't know, not to say he does really horrible things. I'm not excusing that. But I do think that it's interesting the way that it frames him as weak. He's never like explicitly trying to resist what Voldemort is making him do, but...
But he's very submissive.
He's submissive, yeah. I don't know. It's interesting to think about whether, like, why he didn't fight it at all. You know, like, what's in it for Quirrell? I guess power.
Power.
Yeah.
That's, and he explicitly says that in the quote that you singled out.
Yeah.
He's just looking for power.
Yeah.
And Voldemort is going to get him there.
Okay.
In his mind.
I like my villains to be sympathetic.
Maybe later.
Maybe later. Not really. Voldemort is not a sympathetic villain.
But he's a cool cat.
A cool snake. So Harry passes out.
Yeah, Harry passes out and he wakes up in the hospital wing looking directly at Dumbledore's glasses, assuming Dumbledore is there staring down at Harry sleeping.
Not even staring down. I want to think that he's like hovered hunched over him.
Yeah.
Because when Harry's like coming to, he sees something golden ahead of him and he's like, oh, it's the snitch. I have to catch it.
Grab the snitch.
I like to picture him like, it says he can't move his arms because they're too heavy, but I do but like to picture him like swatting at Dumbledore, who's intently leaning over him, which Dumbledore does say like, oh, I thought you might have died. So like he is clearly going to be concerned about Harry. But yes. So Dumbledore's sitting there. He's like, it's okay. You're safe. You have all this candy.
I like that he starts with, please relax or Madame Pomfrey will throw me out.
Madame Pomfrey really does get to shine in this chapter. I love her. She's a great character.
She really is.
Yeah. And it's very funny, the little details about her. The first of which is Dumbledore says, like, your friend sent you all this candy. Fred and George Weasley tried to send you a toilet seat, but Madame Pomfrey didn't think that it would be hygienic.
Yeah.
So she didn't allow it, as if that's the only reason.
That's the only reason you would justify not giving someone a toilet seat.
Yes, I do like that, too, because if you remember Fred and George, when they all get on the Hogwarts Express, yell out the window to Ginny that they're going to send her a Hogwarts toilet seat. So I like to think that that's a common gift for them.
Well, that's like you've successfully taken something that was a part of Hogwarts.
How many toilet seats do you think Fred and George have in their possession?
In their possession?
Yes. At a single moment.
At most one. I feel like most of the toilet seats they've come in contact with no longer reside on toilets, though. I feel like they take a lot of them, but they give them away.
Okay. They're very generous.
Yes.
There is a lot of potty humor in these books, thinking about it. Like, just general toilets are funny. And it prepares us for the next book, which takes place entirely in a toilet.
Yes.
And I wish I was kidding about that. But actually, I don't, because the bathroom in Chamber of Secrets is the best. And so Dumbledore is trying to calm Harry down. But Harry is, of course, like, what happened? Quirrell's there. He's taking the stone. Like, you got to stop him. And Dumbledore is like, it's fine.
Yeah, everything's fine.
I took care of it.
I got there just in time. I do like, he says, what happened down in the dungeons between you and Professor Quirrell is a complete secret. So naturally, the whole school knows.
Which, how would they find out? Because, like, Hermione and Ron, I guess, know some of it. But they don't know about that last confrontation. So the only person that should know is Dumbledore, because he went down there to save Harry. Is Dumbledore gossiping to the students about this? Like, how did that get out?
Well, I don't know if... Well, clearly they don't know everything.
Oh, well, I guess they would also have to address to the students where Professor Quirrell is, but go on.
I'm guessing that the first thing that happened would be Ron went and told the twins.
Mm, yeah.
And that was all that had to happen.
We could probably trace it back to that. Yeah, but Dumbledore is like, you know, not everyone knows the full details. Even you don't know the full details,
yes,
because
you were unconscious.
Out. Yeah.
So he was unconscious for 3 days.
Yes.
The way he said Ron and Hermione's names was interesting. He says Mr. Ronald Weasley and Miss Granger. Like, why does Ron get a first name?
I don't know. I don't read that much into it. I mean, no, I read way too much into everything in these books, but I didn't notice that. What is your theory?
I don't know. Like, I feel like I...
Well, if he had said Mr. Weasley, he had just been talking about Fred and George, so it might have been unclear which Mr. Weasley he was talking about, whereas there's only one Miss Granger.
Yeah, I think you kind of have to do that with when there's so many Weasleys. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Ronald Weasley and then just Miss Granger.
Yeah. Mystery solved.
Okay.
We can stop the podcast now.
It's done. We've solved the most important question.
Yeah. So Dumbledore explains, I went down there and saved you. Quirrell is dead.
Yeah. He just like casually says, oh, and Voldemort abandoned Quirrell to die.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about anyone, not even the people that are trying to help him.
Yes. And Dumbledore says that the Philosopher's Stone will be destroyed, to which Harry asks, like, that means Nicholas Flamel will die. And Dumbledore delivers this nice line that to the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure. That definitely rings later throughout the books.
Yes, but right before that, he says, to one as young as you, I'm sure it seems incredible. But to Nicholas and Perronel, it really is like going to bed after a very, very long day.
And it's a nice idea, I think, how... Not positively Dumbledore speaks about death, but without fear.
Yeah, he's just like, you know, if you're alive that long, you just want something else eventually. I don't know.
No, no. It is true. It's that problem of immortality. You know, you have to watch everyone you know and love die, in this case for Flamel, with the exception of his wife, but it's still messed up.
Yeah. But also, Nicholas Flamel had the stone and could have made anyone he wanted to stay with him alive.
Oh, yeah, true. He could have just shared the elixir. Yes. Dumbledore also encourages Harry to use Voldemort's name in this line, because Harry goes to say, you know who, and Dumbledore says that thing, fear of name equates to fear of itself, fear of the thing itself, which, you know, is interesting. That's a line that Harry or somebody else repeats in the books at some point.
I'm pretty sure Harry's the one that repeats it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like that after this conversation, when Hagrid comes in and then Harry uses his name, Hagrid saying, look, please don't use it. And Harry yells it.
Yeah, he's like, I met him. I can say his name.
Voldemort.
So they kind of go over the immediacy of what happened. But then Harry is basically like, you know, while you're here, I have a lot of questions and I want to know the truth.
And to Dumbledore, Dumbledore replies with the truth is a beautiful and terrible thing and should therefore be treated with great caution. However, I shall answer your questions unless I have a very good reason not to, in which case I beg you will forgive me. I shall not, of course, lie. He basically says, you know, I'll tell you what's convenient for me.
Yeah. What you're allowed to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to get to this level to unlock this information.
I mean, he really does, because Harry's first question is like, why me? Like, why is Voldemort after me specifically? And Voldemort's like,
this is a big part of your identity. You'll find that in a couple books.
Yeah. He's like, I can't tell you now. Wait for later.
Yeah.
Which sucks for Harry. Harry kind of knows not to challenge it. He knew he couldn't press the topic any further, so he just moved on to his next question.
Well, that was why Dumbledore had prefaced
yeah.
the...
Yeah, yeah, prefaced. Yes.
I always want to say prefaced.
No.
But that's not it. But that was why that. That was why Dumbledore had prefaced the questions with, hey, I'm not going to tell you everything.
Yeah, it's just... it opens a bigger conversation about whether Dumbledore should be telling Harry the truth. We can talk about that a lot more when we know what the truth is, and whether it's responsible of Dumbledore to behave the way that he does. Mm-hmm. But then this kind of comes back when Ron and Hermione come into the hospital wing, and Ron is like, do you think that Dumbledore knew? Like, he gave you the invisibility cloak. He seemed to encourage you. He gave you information about what the mirror does. Like, do you think he knew what was going on? And Harry says, I think he sort of wanted to give me a chance. I think he knows more or less everything that goes on here, you know. I reckon he had a pretty good idea we were going to try, and instead of stopping us, he just taught us enough to help. I don't think it was an accident he let me find out how the mirror worked. It's almost like he thought I had the right to face Voldemort if I could. And, like, it's a nice idea that Dumbledore doesn't want Harry to know this difficult information yet because he's still so young. He wants him to be able to be a child. Dumbledore doesn't want to deny Harry the right to confront the person who killed his parents and marked him for life. But
it's troublesome that he's just spoon feeding him just enough.
Yeah.
To get him into serious danger.
Yes. And when being manipulative and being deceptive are called out by this chapter, because that's what Quirrell has been doing this whole time, for Dumbledore to kind of be doing the same thing is a little messed up. And also, it is very irresponsible as somebody who is being tasked with taking care of children to be like allowing them to get into these dangerous situations. But Dumbledore does at least say, I won't lie. I might withhold information from you, but I won't lie to you. Whether that is actually true, I could argue, but we can't yet, because no spoils.
No spoilers. And also, maybe J.K. Rowling just changed her mind.
Harry asks a few other questions of Dumbledore. He asks why he was able to, like, burn Quirrell with his touch. Mm-hmm. And Dumbledore explains that it is because of Lily's sacrifice, that Harry has been marked by something so good, his mother's love, and that's why Quirrell can't touch him, because Voldemort is, he can't feel that power. He's defeated by that power. Which I love for a lot of reasons. First of all, Harry Potter and the Power of Love, which is a title of a Harry and the Potters album, and the Power of Love. Basically, the Power of Love is like the paramount thing in all of these books.
That's a theme that stays with it.
Specifically, mothers are super powerful in the Harry Potter series. Lily, of course, for her sacrifice, and the ultimate mother, Molly Weasley, who I love dearly. I do think, though, that this isn't necessarily a super inclusive thing, because it opens the question of, like, what about those people without mothers? What about those people without mothers that love them? Which, when we get into Voldemort's backstory, I think it's a little icky. But it is a nice idea, though, that Harry, just by virtue of being somebody who is loved, has this power, has this gift.
Yes.
And being somebody who, importantly, can love in return, which kind of develops later on through the books. It's not just being loved, but it's being able to love as well. Harry also asks about Snape, like why he was trying to protect him all this time. Dumbledore says that Snape worked to protect Harry because James saved Snape's life when they were kids, and Snape wants to like get even for it. And
but in such a twisted way, he says,
yeah,
he hated James, but James saved his life, and he wants to make himself even so he can go back to hating James.
It's horrible. Really bad. Like, first of all, he's not doing this out of goodness. He's doing it for his own selfish, hate-fueled reasons. Number two, shouldn't a teacher just try to protect their students in general? Like, why, for somebody who hates people and hates children, is Snape a teacher? And, like, ugh, it's gross.
It's so weird to... And it's also like, I have to... hate on this child while protecting them. I hate your father, so I hate you.
Yeah.
But also, I have to go back to hating your father, so I have to protect you.
Yeah, and it very much paints Snape as somebody who like, the only thing in his life is hatred, in a way.
Yes.
That's it, like, he needs that to keep going. It can't just be like, you know, I have his son in my class. I need to get over something that happened 10, 15 years ago. And we do learn more about this story and why Snape hates James and how it is kind of for justified reasons. And that there is more to why Snape is protecting Harry, but it's still gross.
I feel like it gets worse.
It does get worse. I will not hear any defense of Snape. Dumbledore also explains how Harry got the stone from the mirror. Which I feel like this, Dumbledore basically just like pats himself on the back and says like, I'm pretty smart, aren't I?
I'm really smart. I'm very happy with the way I think.
Yeah. Galadriel in the Ultimate Unofficial Guide to the Mysteries of Harry Potter clarifies this really well, because Dumbledore gives a little bit of an explanation, but she kind of maps it out in a very explicit and clear way.
Well, let me just read the original explanation,
sure,
which is, only one who wanted to find the stone, find it but not use it, would be able to get it. Otherwise, they just see themselves making gold or drinking the elixir of life.
Mm-hmm. Galadriel breaks it down a little bit further into like three possibilities. So one sees in the mirror exactly what one's heart desires. If they seek the stone for its elixir, they don't see how to obtain the stone, but instead see themselves drinking the elixir from it. If they seek the stone for another person, such as Quirrell giving it to Lord Voldemort, they do not see how to obtain the stone. They only see themselves being rewarded as they hand it to their master. However, if they are only looking to obtain the stone itself with no other purpose except to have it in their hand, then they see themselves holding the stone, and thus they do so. It's just basically a way to expand on what Dumbledore said, but I liked the way she broke it down.
Mm-hmm. I feel like his explanation pretty much said the same thing.
It's good. She did note that like at the time that she wrote that book, there were a lot of inaccurate theories about it. She wrote that book in 2002, or I think that's when it was. It was a long time ago. But yeah, I thought that was pretty clear. And I like that idea of like just to have it in their hand, which is pretty much what Harry wants. He just wants himself to have it so that Dumbledore doesn't.
Yes.
So
and in this chapter, he explicitly thinks I have like my biggest
thought.
How can
I get the stone?
Yeah. My biggest desire is to get the stone so that Quirrell can't get it.
Yes.
And in his head, he's like, oh, let me scoot over so I can look in the mirror and see where I would find the stone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it all works out very nicely. I did think after Dumbledore said this, I wonder what happened to the mirror. I don't think we see it again in the books.
Not that I recall.
Yeah. Yeah. So if anybody knows, email in.
I wouldn't be surprised if it ended up in the Room of Requirements.
That's a good theory. So Dumbledore leaves eventually at, is it Madame Pomfrey that kicks him out?
No. So he eats his,
oh, right. Yeah.
He eats his earwax flavored jelly bean and storms out.
Yes. He doesn't storm out. Yeah. And then, Ron and Hermione come to visit Harry. I liked this bit. So Harry is telling them everything that happened. And it says, Ron and Hermione were a good audience and gasped in all the right places, which I thought was very cute.
Yeah. But before that, before Ron and Hermione are able to come in, Harry has to convince Madame Pomfrey to let them in.
So she's like, you've already had all this time. Like, it was.
But you let Dumbledore in. Yes, but he's the headmaster.
And then, like, the whole time Ron and Hermione are there after saving the school and the world, she's like, 5 minutes only.
Yes. Yeah. She's agrees to 5 minutes. And then at the end, after Harry explains everything, tells the full story.
Ron is like, oh, you missed the Quidditch match. And she's like, get out of here. You've had 15 minutes.
Yeah. You've had 15 minutes already. Now out.
Yeah.
And my thought is they change subject from what was happening in the dungeon. Is that why she kicked them out?
Oh, interesting. She's like, you can talk about stay the whole time. Stuff.
Until, like, okay, now I know what happened. I don't need the rest.
Oh, you think she's eavesdropping?
Yeah, I think she was just like, ooh, okay. I want the scoop.
I don't think that Madame Pomfrey is that self-motivated. I think she just loves the rules.
Well, she set those rules for herself.
Isn't it true?
Which was why she was willing to bend them to, you know, get that little inside scoop and find out what exactly happened from Harry Potter.
I was thinking about it from, like, the perspective of, like, I'll let these kids talk amongst themselves if it's about something important. But now that they're talking about frivolous things like Quidditch and the House Cup, they're out of here. Yeah, I did like that as well.
But rewinding a little bit to during their conversation, Harry's explaining everything. He's explaining the stone is going to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And he quotes Dumbledore.
Yes, the death is a great adventure thing. Yeah, death is
the next great adventure. And Ron, I'm going to read this word for word. I always said he was off his rocker, said Ron, looking quite impressed at how crazy his hero was.
I thought that was, is Dumbledore Ron's hero?
Yes.
Has that ever been mentioned before?
I don't think so.
It just seemed way out of place to me.
But he says it again a little bit later. Yeah, Dumbledore's off his rocker, all right, said Ron proudly.
I do like that Ron kind of revels in that. And it's no surprise, given what we see of his home life later on. Ron is just surrounded by crazy people.
but he loves it. That's what matters.
And I think the books overall in Rowling has this real affection for the kind of eccentric genius trope.
Mm-hmm.
So Madame Pomfrey kicks out Ron and Hermione. And then the sweetest scene in the entirety of the books happens. So Hagrid comes to visit. It says that he, like, slides in the door looking too big to be allowed.
Yes.
Sits down next to Harry and bursts into tears. He is blaming himself. He's like, I told him how to get past Fluffy. You could have died. I should be fired. I should never drink again. It's awful. I mean, something else happens too. Do you have anything to say about Hagrid crying?
Okay. I did highlight, I'll never drink again. after he gave up the how to get past Fluffy and put a Harry in danger. It got me thinking when they said Hagrid looked too big to be allowed. Specifically, it's as usual when he was indoors. Hagrid looked too big to be allowed.
That reminded me of you.
I'm not Hagrid size,
You're
though.
Pretty big, though. Go on.
We were talking about when he shows up in the library with his dragon book. And they were like, what are you doing here?
Vindicated.
Maybe it's just because you're giant. What are you doing in this library?
Okay. I still think it was trying to be like, Hagrid, you can't read. What are you doing in the library?
I don't think so.
All right. You think he was just too big?
He was too big to be allowed in the library.
I am picturing Harry, like, between, like, bookshelves in the library, just kind of, like, moving around and bumping them, like, knocking books down, which is cute. But then, as Hagrid is kind of bawling, Harry yells at him for not using Voldemort's name. The saddest thing in the world happens. which made me cry.
Please cheer up, Hagrid. We saved the stone. It's gone. He can't use it. Have a chocolate frog.
What a good way to comfort someone. Hagrid has a gift for Harry.
Yes. Oh, yes.
It says, Hagrid says, Dumbledore gave me the day off yesterday to fix it. Oh, my God. Of course, he should have sacked me instead. Anyway, got you this. It seemed to be a handsome leather-covered book. Harry opened it curiously. It was full of wizard photographs. Smiling and waving at him from every page were his mother and father. Sent off owls to all your parents' old school friends, asking for photos. Knew you didn't have any. Do you like it? Harry couldn't speak, but Hagrid understood.
They have such a great relationship.
I love it. I especially love that line of Harry couldn't speak, but Hagrid understood. Mm-hmm. And I think that a connection point for the two of them is that they're both orphans. Hagrid understands this pain and sadness that Harry has in him for the loss of his parents.
Hagrid had a dad for a long time.
Yes, Hagrid was at least raised by his parents, but once his parents were out of the picture, Hagrid became gamekeeper. I don't want to get too much into Hagrid's past because that's a big thing in the next book, but I feel this is such a sweet moment. Just the pure act of Hagrid giving Harry this photo book, but also that I love that line that Harry couldn't speak, but Hagrid understood. It's such a sweet moment. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I'm tearing up thinking about it. It's so cool. Their relationship really is something magical. And Hagrid, in my opinion, is included as part of the super powerful mothers in the series, along with Molly Weasley.
That's high honor.
It is. It really is. It's so upsetting. It's just the sweetest possible thing that Hagrid could do, because something that we've talked about a lot over the course of doing this book, especially in the Mirror of Erised chapter, is just how affected Harry is, of course, by the death of his parents, and how so much of what happens in this book just rings of the sadness that just follows Harry around at all times because of it. And so this gesture from Hagrid is just the sweetest thing in the world. And I love thinking about Hagrid sitting in his hut with the day off, putting together this photo book for him. It's it's amazing.
What do you think Hagrid's day-to-day activities are?
I was about to say mowing the lawns of Hogwarts, but like taking care of like not the pets, but like
the magical creatures.
Yeah, the creatures in the forests, making sure that the grounds are safe because there's always like bushes trying to attack people at Hogwarts. The taking care of, what are they called? The things that are eating the school cabbages. The blast-ended Skruits? Is that what they are?
No, he breeds those for himself in the fourth book.
He mentions it in the next book, so we'll get to it. But yeah, taking care of the school cabbages is important.
Yes. cutting down trees.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Bringing them inside once a year.
My notes for the Hagrid scene were when he first comes in and starts crying, I wrote, I love him. And then when he gives the photo book, my note was, I love him in all caps. So Madame Pomfrey allows Harry to go to the end of the year feast because Dumbledore specifically told her that she had to.
Yes.
And it's decked out for Slytherin because Slytherin won the House Cup. And Dumbledore pulls some shenanigans.
Yes, very
Dumbledore
last
crushes
minute.
The hopes and dreams and efforts of a bunch of children.
But they're evil, so it's fine.
Yes. Dumbledore gives out just enough points to put Gryffindor in the lead. He gives Harry 60 points. He gives Ron 50 points for the chess game. Yep,
Hermione 50. And then Neville 10.
Yes. I first want to talk about Hermione, because when Dumbledore says this, she buries her face in her arms and bursts into tears.
Do you think that's relief? I feel like she lost those 50 points. She knows she lost those 50 points.
Oh, interesting.
I feel like that's relief for her. Like, I broke even. It's okay now.
I took this as, because I was thinking about the Mirror of Erised and people's deepest desires, do you think that Hermione's deepest desire is, like, if 11-year-old Hermione Granger looked into the mirror, would she see herself receiving recognition from a teacher?
Yes, and she gets it all the time, but it's still she wants the most.
Yes, and I think that's why she burst into tears. Like, I was just recognized by the headmaster
for logic
in front of the whole school. I think that this is like a crowning moment for her.
Before he does that, he starts off his speech calling it an old man's wheezing waffle.
Yeah.
Which I just thought was a great phrase.
Okay.
And when I'm old, I hope I start using it.
Your grandchildren are going to be so annoyed by that.
yes. Yeah. But then he said something that really, like, I really felt what he said after that, which was, he said, what a year it has been. Hopefully your heads are a little fuller than they were. You have a whole summer ahead to get them nice and empty before next year starts.
This is why people have proposed getting rid of summer vacation as 2 months.
No.
Yes, it's because that is too much time to just be like, no, you don't have to learn anymore. You get these 2 months off where you can just forget everything. You get 2 months
to relax and live your life.
Okay, but Neville gets points.
Neville gets points.
Neville gets 10 points, which honestly is kind of a drop in the bucket considering that.
Oh, actually, sorry, I'm going to go back one more time. When they're describing the Slytherins while they're still celebrating winning.
Oh, yeah. Malfoy bangs his goblet on the table.
Yes. And it's described, again, by the narrator. It was a sickening sight.
Honestly, people banging their cups on the table is kind of sickening.
But what was sickening was just Malfoy is happy. That's what picture is being painted.
Yeah, this kid isn't allowed to have nice things. Why would he be?
He's the bad guy, exactly. It seems so black and white.
Yeah.
And just, it was sickening.
It is very harsh.
Our third person narrator is seeing Malfoy happy and celebrating was a sickening sight.
Okay. Neville gets points.
Neville gets points.
Neville gets 10 points.
The only 10 points he'd ever received.
No, it said to this point. We don't know if Neville gets points later on.
No, I know, but like,
yeah.
So far, this entire year,
points. In fact, he has lost points because he got in trouble.
Yes, he's netting negative 40 unless something else happened and he's at less.
So he gets 10 points, which is a drop in the bucket compared to the 50 and 60 that Dumbledore just handed out. But he gets it for standing up to his friends. That Dumbledore says basically that, like, there are so many different types of bravery and it takes a special kind to stand up to your friends. And I love that Neville is recognized here because everyone knows that Harry is the hero of what just happened. Like, everybody knows what happened down in the chamber. Not everybody knows what happened in the common room. Mm-hmm. And honestly, if they did know what happened in the common room, they'd probably be like, Neville, you just tried to stop them from stopping Voldemort. What is wrong with you? So Dumbledore alludes to it in such a way that prevents Neville from receiving that ridicule, but also recognizes like those little unseen acts that are indicative of bravery. It's such a special scene. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think the spell wore off or?
No, I think that somebody found Neville's frozen corpse. Yeah,
somebody found Neville petrified and unfroze him.
I like to think too that like somebody sat down with Ron and Hermione and were like, while Harry was passed out, and we're like, tell me what happened, like, up to this point, like, up to Harry passing out. And they're like, we left Neville in the common room. Like, but it's so sweet.
And he times it out to get the maximum amount of reward for himself.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, 50 points, 50 points. 60 points.
You're tied.
They're tied for first place. Everybody's so excited. 10 points. Neville did it. Neville won.
This does not help Neville's social capital in any way. He is still like the laughingstock of the school.
Well, he gets hugged by all of Gryffindor, that's what matters.
Yeah. This scene in the movie makes me cry. I love Neville. That's kind of how the book ends. I mean, we get the whole thing of they go to King's Cross and get on the Hogwarts Express and their families pick them up. There's a good scene where Hermione sees Uncle Vernon and she doesn't know how anybody can be that unpleasant.
I liked the detail of as every single wizard was leaving platform 9 3/4, they weren't just funneling out all at once. Oh, yeah.
There's a guy there that's like, okay, two.
Okay, now three. Yep.
I want that job.
Is he like half in and half out of the wall so we can see both?
I think that he has magical eyeballs that go through the wall. I'm pretty sure I read that on Pottermore.
Okay.
I'm kidding. That's the thing about everything that J.K. Rowling has published after the Harry Potter series. It's hard to distinguish what's real from what's not because it's all terrible.
That, and then it was very sweet. We get to see Ginny very excited. Oh, Harry's Potter, here. It's Harry Potter. It's Harry Potter. I got to meet him already, but I didn't know it was Harry Potter.
I like also that it explicitly says, like, she first says, there he is. And she's not pointing at her brother, Ron, who she hasn't seen in a year. It's, oh, that's Harry Potter. He's famous.
Yeah.
It's very cute.
And then Harry personally thanks
Mrs. Weasley for the fudge and sweater. Yeah. And she's like, it's not a problem, baby. I love you.
Or, that sounded, oh, it was nothing, dear.
Yeah, what I said sounded worse.
It sounded very creepy.
Yeah, it did.
And you might want to get rid of it.
Yeah. But that's kind of the book.
Yeah. They talk about getting their tests back.
Yes.
They all did well.
Hermione did very well.
Hermione did very well. Even Neville scraped through his good herbology mark, making up for his abysmal potions one.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think anybody ever fails in Hogwarts? Like, are people held back at Hogwarts? Because it does say that Goyle is stupid and
Goyle is stupid
passed.
And managed to pass.
Yeah.
I don't know if he got a very good potions grade.
Maybe. But like, does anybody ever like fail out of Hogwarts?
None of the main characters.
Nobody that we hear about.
Yeah. When you fail out of Hogwarts, you don't get in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And it ends there. Ron does invite Harry over for the summer. So perhaps we'll see that happen in Chamber of Secrets. There's no way to know. So what do you think of this book now that it's done?
I liked it.
Really? That's all you have to say?
That's it. I mean, that's why I'm here, to give my honest and succinct opinion.
I like this book as well. it's not my favorite in the series by far. I definitely...
No, they get better.
They do get a lot better. I definitely do feel that Rowling evolves a lot as a writer, and of course the books and the subject matter in the books evolves as the series goes on and the reader kind of ages with Harry.
I think that's like a very important thing to remember rereading these books.
Yes, absolutely.
Because she is writing for a very young audience, and she is intentional, like, she's getting better as a writer.
Yes.
But she is also intentionally
totally
aging up the books with them. So as I am enjoying them more, it's because, oh, this isn't a...
This has a little more I can relate to. Yeah, it's got a little bit more to it.
Yeah.
And I this book especially is like right on the cusp of like children's literature and young adult literature. There's not clear lines for those things, but I feel like this one kind of dips its toes in both, you know, genres.
Yes.
Whereas by the time it gets to Half-Blood Prince, it is full-on young adult literature.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And before that, probably, too. But Half-Blood Prince, like, especially.
Prisoner of Azkaban is very...
Yeah. That's the one that's kind of starts to tip it. I'm really excited to get to Prisoner of Azkaban, especially because I have historically not been super fond of that book. And I think that's going to change reading it through again. But
We watched the movie recently, and Cassie
that movie.
Decided that she likes the book.
Yeah. That movie is so good. But I think that I always forget about this book a little bit, because even when I first read through the series, I had seen the movie, and then I was like, oh, well, I'll just pick up a Chamber of Secrets. And it took, I read Chamber of Secrets, Prisoner of Azkaban, Goblet of Fire, and it took a while for me to go back and actually read Philosopher's Stone and then see how different it was from the movie. So I think I always, you know, I don't consider this book as much as I should, but I think it's really good. I think that Rowling does an incredible job of setting up this world, of creating enough mystery to keep you reading and get you excited for the next book, where but still like answering enough questions where you don't feel like she's just withholding information from you. She's very Dumbledore like in that sense, where she's like, here's what you're allowed to know at this point. She very much
I mean, she is doing it all through Dumbledore as well.
Through Dumbledore, totally. Yeah. It's a great book. We're not going to finish a lot of these books and I'm going to be like, this one was a total bummer.
We'll see. There's always Prisoner of Azkaban.
I think I'm going to like it. You don't have any other thoughts on this book other than I like it?
I like Peeves. Especially, did you go into Chamber of Secrets and be like, who is Peeves?
So I was reading Chamber of Secrets and my sibling had gone back and like we both wanted to read through the series because we were both big readers and they were like, well, I'm going to start at the first one. I'm going to read Sorcerer's Stone because we're American. I'm going to read Sorcerer's Stone. I'm like, I don't need to do that. I'm just going to jump straight to Chamber of Secrets. So if I had any questions like that, I imagine I would have just asked them. I do also feel that Chamber of Secrets does enough to kind of catch you up. You know, like Hogwarts was a wizarding school. Mm-hmm. Pretty sure they explicitly explained that early on. But yeah, I think that this book is a great start to the series. And it's no surprise that it got the acclaim and fame that it did when it first released.
Yeah. Was it famous?
It was an instant.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. How long did it take to get from Europe to America?
Not long at all. I don't think
long enough to change the name.
Yeah. I mean, we can find out real quick.
I know Control F, find and replace is pretty easy.
I'm an idiot and Googled Philosopher's Stone. let's see. Publisher. Publication date, June 97 in the UK, September 98 in the US. Actually, that's a lot of time. That's over a year.
Yeah.
I imagine a lot of people were importing copies because it was such a sensation. I don't think that it really caught on until it hit the US. At least it didn't get kind of the media fanfare that it did until it really hit the US. Mm-hmm. That's just my recollection of what I've read about it. It did take a decent amount of time from the book coming out to the movie coming out, because I believe the movie was 2001. So that's 3 years. And I think Chamber Prisoner of Azkaban.
Prisoner of Azkaban was definitely out before they signed that contract to get the rights to it. I don't think it was, I'm going to be writing these books knowing a movie is happening until she was working on Goblet of Fire.
You think she was writing Goblet of Fire when the first movie was being made, like when she signed the contracts?
I think Prisoner of Azkaban was done before the first movie came out.
Yeah, Prisoner of Azkaban was 99. Oh my gosh. She wrote 3 books in 3 years. Goblet of Fire might have been out when that first movie came out.
I thought there was a big gap between Goblet of Fire.
No, the gap was between Goblet of Fire and Order of the Phoenix.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
It would make sense that any movie company wouldn't take a book series that didn't at least have a good dent in it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, totally.
She was
very clear from the beginning that it was going to be 7 books. So they at least knew the intention was there. I know what you're saying, though, where they want to make sure that she's not going to like give up and not do it for a year and a half and not say anything. And people just assume that the project is abandoned.
Is that what happened?
That's a self burn on us.
Oh, yes, yes. A year and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah. That adds up.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe that she put out 4 books in 3 years.
That's insane. Can't even put out 9 episodes in 1 year.
What was I going to say?
I don't know.
Okay. Then we should just end. Oh, gosh. We have to do Spell of the Week.
Yeah, I was worried you were just going to end it.
All right, it's time for Spell of the Week.
So our Spell of the Week, I chose Incarcerous, which is the spell that conjures ropes to tie up people, which is what Quirrell used on Harry. He uses it non-verbally in later books. We find out what the actual incantation is. Which is just Incarcerous.
Cool. Good to know.
Yeah, so the name is invented in book 3, but it's the only spell I could think of actually being used this chapter.
Yeah, I think so.
So the spell is Conjuration, which I didn't know there were like very specific.
Oh, yeah, like the difference between like hexes and charms and all that stuff. I guess conjuration is another category.
Conjuration is advanced transfiguration because you're not you're not transfiguring something into you're something else. You're conjuring it okay. out of thin air.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
So the etymology, incarcerous, like incarceration in jail and prison. That's what I was going to make up off the top of my head if I didn't find the specific etymology, which said that.
Yeah, she really just lifted the Latin word straight out of it. Most
she
of the time,
added
like,
an O.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I didn't mean to diminish her efforts there.
I wonder if that would have worked on Fluffy and he didn't need to figure out a different way to get rid of him.
I think you would need a specific spell to tie up a dog because you got to like hog tie it.
Well, actually,
is there a spell to tie up dogs?
The rope bind trading card specifically has a dog tied up.
Can I see the picture?
Yes, of course.
Man, I need to get those trading cards.
it's a black dog with a spiked collar.
Is it Fang?
I don't know. I'm not sure what the Harry Potter trading card version of Fang looks like.
I'm not sure either. I don't have
so I'll have to look
anymore.
That up.
Yeah, hold the picture up to the microphone so that everybody can see
okay,
it.
Okay, good.
maybe I'll open a P.O. box so people can send me trading cards.
Don't beg to the people.
And so that is Philosopher's Stone. We will be moving on to Chamber of Secrets. We have some ideas on how we want to maybe change some things, tweak some things, tweak our formula for Chamber of Secrets. If you have, of course, any feedback that you want to share with us, like, hey, I hate Spell of the Week, so change this. We will read it, at least. I can't promise we'll act on all of it.
Also, we're thinking if we get enough corrections. I know up to this point you haven't heard us address any corrections except for maybe before the break. That was a year and a half.
Yeah.
If we get enough of them and they seem relevant,
yeah,
we can have a separate episode focusing on them.
Yeah. Or if we get like a ton of emails and we want to do like an email episode.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. We'll see what happens. There may be a bit of a break between when we finish Philosopher's Stone and Chamber of Secrets. It will not be a year and a half.
Just
like last
just a
time.
Year.
Yeah. We'll cut down to that. Yeah. But yeah. So if you have any ideas on how to change the podcast to make it better, we'd love to hear them. Keep in mind, Spell of the Week was a listener suggestion that we just put in as a regular segment. So we're open to all kinds of suggestions. And of course, you can connect with us. So we have a website, podterrificustotalis.com, where you can listen to all of our episodes. You can find detailed show notes. We have transcripts for some episodes. It's a great resource if you like the podcast or want to share the podcast. You can also email us at owlpost@podterrificustotalis.com. That is owlpost@podterrificustotalis.com. And there you can send your corrections, your thoughts, and just share your experience with the Harry Potter series because we like to hear that. You can follow us on Twitter at Podterrificus or Tumblr. We have a Tumblr account, I'm pretty sure, at podterrificustotalis.tumblr.com. We have a Facebook page, all that good stuff. So connect with us, talk with us. We'd love to hear from you folks. And we will see you next time for Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Do you know what the first chapter is called?
The Worst Birthday.